So we have a question from Rebecca. It gives you three options. Would you like to have a review for the final exam?
Yes.
Okay, that answers one of the options, so no will not be the selection. Okay. Would you like to have it on Friday, May 16th at 1 p.m.? I don't know what planet she's on, but... this is what I'm thinking. Or how about Saturday, May 17th at noon? This is not going to be a hard one, is it?
Is there a lacrosse game that day?
Lacrosse game?
Yes, there's a big lacrosse game.
Big lacrosse game? Lots of people on the field?
There's a graduation, the UMEC graduation just Saturday from like 9:30 to noon, so there might not be time.
You can have a further extended email discussion with Rebecca by email, but I took the question from her to bring to you. Would you like to have it on Friday, Saturday, or not at all? What's that? You want one on Saturday and you'd like her to arrange parks. Very good. I will tell her Saturday is received the most votes and that Friday received only confused ones. Okay. Questions? No questions. Okay, then I have a question for you. Which is more complicated? A 747 or a train? What's your measure of complicated?
So if it has a part.
If it has a lot of parts, then it's more complicated. Okay. Good. Which is more complicated? A train or the Empire State Building? Because?
That's what my engineering deal with. Mm-hmm. That's my philosophy.
That's why I'm on the building. Okay. Which is more complicated, the Empire State Building or the Internet? Well, which one has more pieces? Yeah, which one has more details to be kept track of? What's the most complicated thing human beings have ever made? And they don't even know how they do it. Well, okay. With the intention, what's the most complicated thing engineers can do? Using an engineering thought. We get this constrained, quite frankly. You probably didn't think of this when you came into this class. You thought of computers as complicated things. But computers are actually very simple things. If you want a computer that will send a message someplace, you get a computer and you program it to send a message. If you want a computer that will run your GPS, you get a computer and you program it to run the GPS. So it's the same computer. Right? You go by, exactly the same chip from the same place, you put it together in the same way, and then you program it differently. Right? So what computers have done is they've taken, in the Industrial Revolution, engineers had to build devices, and the design was realized in the device itself. You designed a different device for weaving than you did for generating electricity. Right? So you had to think about the design of the problem and then build a physical device that would do whatever it was that needed to be done. But now what happens is whatever it is you want done, that's a valid reason, you buy a computer, the same computer you would have bought for anything else you wanted done, and the only thing that's different is the program. Right? You program the computer differently. So the most complex thing that people have ever created, human beings not with it, is software. It's software where all that complexity comes together. You don't run into somebody and say, what do you do? And they say, oh, I design computer chips. Very few people you meet design computer chips. But you meet a lot of people who say, oh, I design software. That's not the way they say it. They say, I'm a programmer. So it's the programmers who got all the complexity. Right? They sort of inherited all the complexity of the things that needed to be done. And so programmers had to learn over time to organize their effort in ways that made it possible for them to manage complexity, because we had taken the complexity and pushed it their way. Now, back in the 1950s, a new breed of engineer came along who wasn't qualified to do any kind of engineering. They couldn't build a bridge, they couldn't build a building, they couldn't build a computer, they couldn't build a rocket. So they weren't an engineer in the nameable sense. They weren't an aerospace engineer, a mechanical engineer, or an electrical engineer. But rather they were a systems engineer. And what they would do is they would take systems that other people had designed at a detailed level, and they would figure out how to get those systems to work together to accomplish some task. And so that process became known as systems engineering. And so some of what we'll talk about today is the fundamental things that systems engineers do, which is they analyze what the requirements are for the system. So when you come to a new problem, if you're an engineer and you know about geek stuff, you don't necessarily understand how to solve problems in the world. So somebody has to understand what the workflow is to get some problem solved, what the data flow is, the information flow, what the authorization structure is, who can authorize which kinds of things, which things might need to be reversible, right, in the event that something gets done that was inappropriate, which things need to be auditable. So these are all things that come from the requirements level, and they drive what needs to be built. So we'll start out by talking about where that comes from, how that gets done. Then we'll talk about building complex systems and managing complex systems. And because you always seem tired at the end of class, I thought in the final exam review at the end. Now, if the idea of doing the final exam review 2 weeks before the final is so that you can bring more questions back next week. We'll spend most of the time next week doing project presentations. I'll talk about that at the end of class too. But then I'll also be happy to stay after class if the project presentation takes the whole time and answer any questions that you have. And then Rebecca will have that session scheduled more time. Okay, clear what we're done? So, first we have to figure out what kind of a system we want to build. Then we have to design it. We've got to build it, and we've got to live with it. So this is sort of a natural progression. Right? And it would be really nice if we could do it this way, except that we can't actually figure out what we want to build until we get down here and we're in the process of managing it. And we figure out that, well, that wasn't actually what we needed. Right? So you get down here and you land up cycling. And so you see usually several iterations of this cycle. Okay. So let's just take a sample task. Let's take creating a web page for your newspaper. Right, so the New York Times, when the web was new, thought, hey, we could put the news up on the web, and then people would see the news on our web page, and they'd see what kind of news we have, but web page isn't a great way to see the news, so they'd be more likely to subscribe to the New York Times. Right, that was the thinking. So I want to put a web page up with New York Times news on it. Where am I going to get ideas for how to do this?
I mean, I can't look at all the other webpages that all the other newspapers have because there aren't any yet, right? We're trying to do something for the first time. So where do I look?
The actual newspaper.
I look at the actual newspaper, right? And what would I see in the newspaper that would be useful to me? So I want to break stories up in some way, maybe not into columns on the web, but I'm going to break stories up into somehow. What else would I find? Okay, so there's sections, so I'm going to want some sort of a navigation structure, right? You can start to sort of imagine a web page structure emerging. What else would I find from a regular newspaper that would be helpful?
Who wrote the stories in the newspaper?
Authors. Okay, so it's going to be important to have the author's name.
Boss logos. Physical appearance.
So I'm going to want to brand it in some way. I'm going to want the New York Times to be written in the same way on my web page as it is, so I can connect the two. So I'm going to want pictures, and I'm going to want the pictures to be the sort of pictures that you would have found in the New York Times. Okay. Okay, or at least I'm going to want to think about whether that's what I'm trying to do. So far nobody has said you'd want to update it every day. I mean, that's what the newspaper was, right? It was updated every day. So there's a workflow, there's an entire process flow inside a newspaper, and that process flow was to get the presses to start at a certain time. So you might think there'll be a certain time when the web page gets updated. That's not how we think now, but it's what you would have found if you went to the New York Times when they were starting to do this. Because there wasn't anything else. You're thinking of a whole different workflow. But the question is, how do you understand the task? So you go in and you look at what people are doing, and you pick up the good things that they're doing and the bad things that they're doing. Right? You can't tell them apart when you're starting. You just pick up what they're doing and try to put it into the environment. Now, why would you want to do this on the web rather than simply printing more newspapers and giving them away?
Possibly to started out,
being
able to access it, you know,
the
potential.
So they have a greater influence?
Exactly. Yeah.
Outlet of resources would be different. I mean, you have the human resources and you have to pay for the website, but you would have to pay for paper.
Okay, so this could be a cost control mechanism if we could get people to pay us for access, which several newspapers tried and abandoned.
You know, you have a login system, so you know who's looking at it and what they're looking at.
Ah! And the New York Times did that very early on, right? Because the New York Times knows a lot about its subscribers. They know where they live. They know how much money people in that area make. And that's very important to them because that's what they sell to their advertisers. This gave them information about what you were reading, which they thought about selling to their advertisers. So, the key question here is, once you understand the way in which things are done, then the question is, which of these things are you trying to overcome? Do you mean that I'm trying to overcome the once-a-day news cycle? To overcome the once-a-day news cycle requires you to completely re-engineer the news process. And that's hard to foresee. But if you're in a business where money comes from advertising and you're thinking targeted advertising, probably get more money per exposure. That was the big driving factor in how the web was commercialized, was to put advertising up and to change the advertising depending on who was looking at it. So this was in the discourse, and it could quite possibly have been something that the New York Times would have thought of right away.
saying that the talent literacy complete in depth story, so it's like giving you a taste of it, are they something that you buy that you use the hard copy to see the whole story?
I suppose they could be.
Well, you can buy an online subscription of certain services now too. Like, after a certain date, you can't see all the articles, you have to pay for them.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be it as well.
Okay. So you can think about what were the limitations of the existing approach, and one of the limitations of the existing approach that the New York Times very much wanted to get by was that they couldn't tell what you read in the paper. So they put up these big banner ads, but they couldn't charge a lot of money for them, these big page-wide ads. They couldn't charge a lot of money for them because they weren't only going to the people who wanted to see them, and they're having to pay a lot to print them all. Right, so this gave them something that they could put up cheap advertising, target it, and charge more for it. Okay, so you can come up with, for any given task, the limitations of the existing approaches that you want to try to overcome. Now, if you're going to try to put a new process into an existing system, you're limited to some extent by the existing system. So for example, what are the environmental factors within which the New York Times works? Where do they get their news from? They buy it from AP or UPI or AFP or whatever sources for some of it. Right? So they don't have much control over the way in which those stories are written, right? They have control over the way their stories are written. So now if you're going to edit stories differently for the web than you're going to do for the print version, you're going to have to build an entire process to generate your news stories, and there's little that you can do in the early days about AP. You don't have much market power on AP. So you have to build something that kind of lives with AP the way it is. What else do you have to live with? What are the environmental factors you think about if you were the New York Times in that time frame? What else is there in the structure of the industry to worry about?
It's all based on reporting, and you don't know what's going to happen. You know that, okay, I want to have one main story and then two kind of secondary stories each day, but who knows if the news is actually going to serve it up that way.
Okay, but how is this, so what I'm looking for is things that would restrict the structure of what you could do. I mean, that's...
I mean, if you built a template for mm-hmm. a website and you set it up so that you have a main story and then you have...
Two other stories, and then it turns out there are five things you need on the front page that
right,
day.
Right, you're limited by what the screen can actually show.
Okay. Right. So one of the main issues is having to figure out what the installed base of display equipment in this time is going to be able to do before you can figure out what you're going to do with that, how you're going to lay it out. So how would I know if I was the New York Times what the download speed was? And that's controlled not by the New York Times, but by the person who wants to see the New York Times, right? That's different for different users. So what would I have to go looking at? I'd have to look at statistics. They wouldn't tell me what the download speed was. They'd tell me how many people had this, how many people had that, how many people had this other download speed, right? And then how would I accommodate these different speeds? Would I have like five different New York Times? Would I have one that was designed for the slowest speed? What would you do? Yeah?
Isn't there some kind of software out there that can determine, like ping your computer and determine what your speeds are?
Sure.
And then it can say, okay, call up this speed and send it?
Yes. So that's what you do.
It's starting out not knowing other things.
That's a pretty expensive solution.
right? So now I have to build several different front pages. Some with video on them, some with, well, not video in that type, but with images on them, some without images, some with lots of stories, you know, small fonts, some with big fonts, depending on the information I get back about your display. And people do that now for mobile devices. But what you would normally do starting out is you would pick a cutoff and say, I'm just not going to support anybody with equipment slower than this, because I can't give them a good experience. And if the equipment's better than that, I'm not going to make very good use of it. So I'm going to make one thing first. And you normally make that a little bit bleeding edge and make it just a feasibility study and see what you could provide, with the idea that the technology will sort of catch up with you a little bit while you're doing your feasibility study. And then your feasibility study will tell you whether you need to do something to capture something down market or whether the market's going to catch up with you. Okay. So once you've got a picture of what's going on, the next thing to do is to start to identify data flows. Now, this is harder for me to do with the New York Times because I don't know much about the newspaper industry. Anybody here know a lot about the newspaper industry? Okay. So let's do it with libraries. All right, how many people here know a lot about libraries? Come on, somebody's got to test up. Anybody? Yes? What's that?
This is why we're here.
To learn it, or because you know it?
No, I don't know it.
You don't know it?
I was saying, never mind.
You probably know more about it than I do. So let's try to design an integrated library system. We're going to design a system for, let's say, an academic library. Just to think about where the data flows. So what kinds of functions, go back and understand the task, what are the functions of a library that you might be able to computerize? Yeah.
Circulation.
Circulation. Okay.
Well, I need some ability to erase in some of the same mistake. But we'll start with
Avalanche. Well.
Interlibrary loan. Okay. Hold on a second. Let me order up a better marker. Any markers in there? Oh, yes, which is a really good answer.
Okay, what's next?
Preference.
Or just started doing major clusters and libraries. What else?
Page string record.
What does that mean?
Well, customer record. I mean, it can kind of go along with circulation. Yeah.
Okay.
I can do
that
right here. Okay.
It's part of it. What they have checked out, what they don't have checked out.
Okay.
Employee information,
IG. Personnel. Getting bad. Okay, I can see if you can.
Acquisitions.
Hold on a second, we're going in search of a better marker. No, we're living with this one. Okay, what's next? User instruction. What's that? Okay. Yeah.
Collection development.
Collection development, like collection policy, that sort of thing, or?
Well, it goes along with acquisition. It can go along with reference items, too.
Okay. I'm going to be able to read this. God. What else?
An events calendar.
What's that?
An events calendar.
Events calendar.
still going looking for more of these. Be right back. That's good. Actually, we can just turn this on this computer if we have to. What else? Yeah.
Like the business practices, accounting, things of that nature.
Okay, accounting. God, I hope it couldn't be any worse.
Did you have like three of them so that when this one dies, we got another one?
Okay, thank you. Actually lasting pretty well. Okay, what's next?
Any community or area of information about the library?
Hours and stuff like that?
Hours, services, other county services that are...
Okay, so this is an academic library.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm thinking of...
but we have...
Well, I mean, you might want to know about the community around that, around that college.
Okay.
The question was things in the library, in an academic library, that we could...
We don't have to computerize all these things. We might decide there's something here like user instruction that we actually want to do with human beings. You know, you don't have to computerize things, but first I want to know what the functions are.
I think it would be something that uses different catalogs, meaning the actual catalog of the library.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Questions?
Good. Okay, so we'll think of more of them, but that's a good list to start. So, let's pick, now, another thing we don't have to erase. Scares me what's going to happen when we use it. Good. So, which of these things do you want to start with? What do we want to anchor with? Circulation? Okay, so we'll just anchor with circulation. So the circulation system has to get information from someplace. Where does it get information from? We're doing a data flow diagram.
It gets information
from the catalog. From the catalog, okay. So cataloging. Gives information to cataloging the function, gives information, the catalog, which you could label here if you wanted to, it's just starting to get messy, to circulation. Is that the only place that circulation gets information? Okay, so we had user information up here. And, but we call that part of circulation. So that's it, right? That's the only place up here that we get information from.
And then we have information from the university databases.
From the university databases about users.
About
users. Okay, so we didn't have the university databases up there, but we might get some external information about authorized users or something.
And the library loan,
what do we get from your library loan?
Because you have the books coming into the system, and then you have to
check
the record of who you
checked
that outside item to.
I see. Okay, so I have to get interlibrary loan will inform circulation. Right? So if I get interlibrary loan, it says, okay, we got this item, circulation will lend it, get it back, and then interlibrary loan. Correct. Which means that I have information going from circulation back to interlibrary loan before we check that in. Okay, good. So, who
who uses information from circulation?
Library personnel.
What do they use it for?
Keep track of records of overdue books, who has what, any fines that need to be collected.
So I'm going to have some accounting is going to get information from circulation?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And we could go labeling all these. What kinds of information?
Well, sometimes it can even be an outside collection agency.
Okay. No. Yeah.
Acquisitions or collection development, whatever we want to call it, so they know what's being checked out so they can decide what else, what they should collect.
Okay, so circulation is going to feed acquisition. Actually, circulation is going to feed collection development, right?
Yeah.
Which is going to feed acquisition. If I think of this as policy. Right. What's acquisition fee?
Accounting.
Okay.
And cataloging what you get
has to. Oh, now that's awfully messy, isn't it? I need to go. Everything went this way, right? It's not that I object to drawing big loops. Where does it start? I mean, we started with circulation, right? Because we thought it was the center of the universe. But it turns out that cataloging is the center of the universe, which any cataloger would tell you, right? The only thing we can decide is that interlibrary loan is certainly not at the center. Because they're just sitting here vestigially. They talk to circulation, circulation talks to them, but they don't talk to anybody else. Talk to accounting. They have to talk to accounting.
And possibly acquisition, because it interrupts the same item gets requested all the time.
So they have to talk to collection development.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, and who else?
Well, I
said
reference.
It's not up there. Where does reference go? Where does, how does reference interact with all this? But there are no users. Well, there's the list of authorized users.
Isn't reference more of a subset of cataloging?
Well, I'm sure the catalogers would like to think of it that way. The reference librarians might, you know, like object.
Well, for our rudimentary purposes here.
But I mean, in a real library, there are a bunch of people doing reference and a bunch of people doing cataloging.
Well, I meant,
you know, one is from Mars, the other is from Venus.
I think I have my definition.
I didn't say which was good. Okay, but reference belongs here. It feels like we've got a library that has no reference. Part of circulation? Reference is a good functional value. Look, you can just write it down, right? Top of everything.
Here we go.
Okay, make the reference librarian happy. Now, what does it connect to? What do the reference librarians care about?
Collection. They can't do their job if they don't have
a collection here. I thought cataloging meant the collection. That's why I asked the question earlier. Because I was going to say, what about the collection itself? But I was under the impression that cataloging
is describing the collection.
That.
Yes.
So
they interact with the catalog.
Correct.
Right? Okay. So I could actually, we don't really have a catalog here yet, right? But I could stick a catalog in. And then cataloging could interact with the catalog. Circulation could interact with the catalog. Reference could interact with the catalog. Interlibrary loan could actually interact with, well, it could do the catalog, but we'll just leave it off by itself.
Okay, so now we've got reference in here, right? Is that the only thing that reference interacts with?
Yeah, I mean, this is just the names of users, right?
Yeah, but I mean,
those aren't real users.
We need another offshoot of that.
We need people.
Yes, the users interact with reference, they interact with the catalog, they interact with actual users interact with catalog and circulation and reference.
Yeah, except I don't really want the users up here. I'm trying to look at the data flow among the elements of the things I might computerize.
Database.
What's that?
That's a collection.
I don't have a collection up here. So you're saying I've got a bunch of databases, right?
The database is different.
Where are they? So the databases cause problems for accounting, thus causing cancellations, which I guess is collection development. So accounting seems to actually be the main driver for collection development. Annual emails on serial cancellation. So, if you were going to design an integrated library system, one system that you go out and buy for your library, which of these functions would you like it to support? Now, you can answer that question in two ways. You can say, well, what would need to be in such a system for the system to be usefully integrated. For example, could I put acquisitions and databases and nothing else? Not too good, right? These things don't really talk to each other. Right? So I could put acquisitions, accounting, and databases. Maybe that would make sense, because at least these things are connected now. So for an integrated system, I want things that are connected to each other. I also like to avoid unnecessarily integrating everything. So which one of these has the most rapidly changing technology? Because maybe I don't want to integrate the thing where the technology will be outdated 3 years from now, but I still am stuck with my integrated library system. So where's the technology changing the fastest here?
Catalogs?
I think so. So the reason why databases are not well integrated is not that they couldn't be well integrated. I mean, they interact beautifully with a description of the physical objects. The physical objects, the virtual objects, I can move between them. The reason they're not well integrated is because these things are changing at the speed of light, and this thing is changing at the speed of molasses. I mean, I'm not, you know, I do some acquisitions, I update the catalog, I do some weeding, I update the catalog, but those things are very slow processes compared to what's happening over here. Where I got entirely new databases coming in, I've got changes in the structure of the industry, right, at a pretty rapid clip. So I would like to keep my databases separate to keep my design problem simple, even at the cost of providing less good service to my user now. And I wouldn't make that decision 10 years ago. When the database industry shakes itself out, I'm going to want to capture inside my integrated library system a much more sophisticated way of linking databases. Right now we use things like SFX to link the catalogs to the databases, which is a very kludgy approach, requires a lot of individual work by every library. And we can avoid a lot of those problems if we more closely integrate stuff. But because the structure of the industry is changing so fast here, because the technology is changing so fast here, I want to keep that separate. What else do I want to keep separate here? What else is the technology changing pretty fast? So how many of you know about email reference? many of you know about chat restaurants? How many of you know about being able to grab the screen? So, way time back in 2-year increments when these things didn't exist, right? This is a rapidly moving process. Now look at the thing that made it possible for me to say databases were isolated, but they weren't connected to very many things in the information flow. Right? And look where reference is heading up here. It easily segregated. It's not sitting in the middle with everything connected to it. I mean, it's really hard to take circulation out of this picture. But it's not too hard to take reference out of it. So what I get is I get somebody with a chat reference system that's not integrated with the catalog. They have a catalog application, a chat reference application, and they have these two applications open at the same time, and I'm relying on the human to move information between them. If you look at that from a systems engineering standpoint, you say, that's nuts. From the standpoint of usability, and our designing for the user, I want to really support that reference library as well. Right, so I want these two things to be integrated. So that when the reference librarian gets a question, I like the catalog to say, hey, we have books with those words in the title. Right? But we don't have that right now. We don't have that right now because the technology for this is changing very rapidly. And I've got a large sunk cost in the catalog and circulation and accounting and things that are relatively stable. Okay, so where else would you sort of break a link and say, I'm going to chop something off? What other kinds of logic are there for cutting things off? Okay, so let me ask you a question. How many of you actually work in libraries? Okay. Y'all could have answered that one earlier, you know. If next week's paycheck was off by 30%, would it bother you? Mm-hmm. Okay. What if some book was in the catalog, but it wasn't actually on the shelf, but the catalog showed it was on the shelf? Would that bother you? Would it bother you just as much? Well, not wherever you're working in the library now, you're on the Google. But it bothers you just as much as when your paycheck goes down by 30%? So the audit requirements on accounting are very different from the audit requirements on circulation, right? I mean, if somebody manages to sneak out of the library with a book, it's not a good thing. It's not nearly the same thing as doubling somebody's salary and not being able to trace that. So you get all sorts of audit requirements over here that don't exist over here. In fact, if you try to draw a line where the audit requirements are just different, where would you draw that line here? Now, where would you put it? I mean, would you put accounting and circulation together? You put interlibrary loan and accounting together? You put all these things together and draw the line that way? You don't have to draw a straight line. What will you cut here? You cut off interlibrary loan. Collection development? Yeah. Acquisition? Circulation, databases, you'll make that its own little thing, and you hire people with expertise from this. And you would say to them, if you violate the procedures encoded in this system, alarms will go off, and you will not be long for the world. And then you would tell the people over here that, I'm sorry, I had to spend all my money getting that right, and we don't really have enough money to run this part, but, you know, do the best you can. And if a couple of things go wrong, well, we understand, you know, we under-resourced and all that, but nobody's going to get fired if this part goes wrong. This part goes wrong, the person who runs the library is going to be gone. Right? So if you come in and you sell me an interlibrary loan system, you start drawing this picture on the board, as soon as you draw accounting at the center of the picture and you connect everything in the library to it, and you give access to this system to everybody in the library for their function. Remember that multi-level security, how hard that was to do? Yeah. I look at this as a manager, and I'm like, I'm just not going to let you do that. Because I have a different set of controls on this than I have on this. Okay. So that gives us something that has exactly the structure we want. Look at what it looks like. It's a ring. So if you buy me an integrated system, and the people here do something that the people here use, and the people here do something the people here use, the people here do something the people here use, all right, so I've got this linear flow of information, never closes back on itself, then I can chop it at any point, have two systems, and it actually gets simpler to manage. Because I only have to move by hand the information across this one interface, and then this piece up here can evolve at a different rate than that piece down there. You have experience with this already. Why is Access a different piece of software than Excel, which is different than Word? It's because, well, there's a lot of functionality in Word. It can do tables, for example. Access can do tables. Excel can do tables. If you were drawing a picture like this, you'd say, oh, we can put them all together and we'll just have one thing and we'll call it like Lotus 1-2-3 or something. I don't know. And it will die of its own weight. So there's a sort of a natural ability to carve things up into small enough pieces. So if I had a linear flow, I'd start looking for where can I carve things up into natural pieces. I want them tightly coupled within the piece, and I want them loosely coupled at everything else. And I want them to be of a similar type. Does that make sense? But I can't do that here. Because I've got, you know, this is like the old song, right? The five bones connected to the knee bone. The knee bone connected. Remember this? Yeah? Okay. So, catalog is connected to the catalog. It's right there. The catalog is connected to circulation. Circulation is connected to collection development. Collection development is connected to acquisitions. And acquisitions is, of course, connected to catalog. So, you go and you buy an integrated library system. What do you get? Well, not too surprisingly, that's what you get, because that's the thing you should be integrating. Okay, see how this works? I have some problem in the world. I think about what its parts are. And then I think about how information moves between them. And then, contrary to what you would have expected, where you would have expected me to say, okay, we'll just make one big amorphous blob, but let's get rid of as many things as we can here that don't belong. So you get like these puzzles in the paper that say, you know, what doesn't belong in this picture? Right? You look for things that don't belong. And we found two reasons to remove things that didn't belong. One was, I have something that's changing at a rate that's different from the rate other things are changing. Right? So I've got two of those here. The other was, I've got things that have a different level of management control, a different level of accountability, a different level of audit, a different level of access control. So I want to separate those functions. You could come up with other reasons for wanting to separate functions. So I gave you a cut the weakest link argument, right? If I've got a few things up here and a few things down there, with Excel as an example, Access as an example, Word as an example. Want to cut them in places where cutting them doesn't hurt much, and it gains us a little coherence. Right. So that things can evolve separately. Okay. So, the one thing we didn't discuss, noted up here, is are there pieces that you just don't want to automate. So for example, if you were drawing that picture 10 years ago, you might not have thought about automating reference. Or if you did think about automating reference, you might have been thinking about something very self-contained, you know, sort of taking an index card file and making it a web page or something like that. as opposed to something potentially more fancy. Okay, so that's sort of one piece of this. That's the very top level requirements analysis. So you actually have requirements engineers come in, and they talk to you about how things work, and they put together pictures like that. Then when you actually start to build something like this, how do I know what a good cataloging system would be? If I'm a computer programmer, I mean, I have no hope of understanding what a cataloging system should do if my professional education is in computer programming, right? So how do I learn? Now, roll yourself back to a day in which there are no automated cataloging systems and we're creating one for the first time. What do I do? I talk to the cataloger, and what I find out is about these little catalog cards, right? Because that's what we have before we start building something like this. So, this will give me an idea of the present practice. But what if the cataloger doesn't understand what the computer can do? So, for example, in catalog cards back in the old days, you would have one catalog card that had an author first, one catalog card that had a title first, and one catalog card that had like a subject heading first or something. But that would limit the number of subject headings I would want, because I'm printing a catalog card every time, and that's a catalog. But of course, I can have any number of subject headings now, so I can't very well ask a cataloger how many subject headings do I have. That's a question that's never come up before. If you could have an unlimited number of subject headings, what number would you want? That would depend upon what the user who was searching wanted. But the user who was searching never had an unlimited number of subject headings available before, so they won't know either. So you run into this problem. You can find the present users of the technology, but there may be future users that you can't actually interview because they're going to come along later. And then you want to understand what they need and consider two possibilities. One possibility is you'll just go buy the system that will solve the problem. The other possibility is that you will build. This is the classic problem that businesses have, make versus buy. Anybody want to guess what the University of Maryland did when faced with this problem? First time? They built it. What major research universities do, right? You get some problem, or whatever. So they built it. They built an absolutely atrocious system. Well, kind of what you would expect, right? I mean, the entire university wanted to build this game. Somebody's test project to build this thing. They went off and built it. There was nobody around to ask how it should work. What's that? Instead of a computer science equivalent of the 695, that's before computer science really knew what it was doing. So then, they eventually figured out that was a really bad idea. So they went off and they bought a system. And then having bought the system, the manufacturer was interested, the builder of the system, was interested in getting people to adopt their system. So they wanted the University of Maryland's, you know, endorsement on this. And so they said, here's what we'll do. We'll customize the system for you so that it does what you need. So they got the University of Maryland got the customized version. Every single time they issued an update to that system, the University of Maryland then had to pay to get the customized version updated. Right? And so this time around, they were like, let's find one we like, and let's just live with it. So you go through these multiple cycles where the industry can't support it, and you have to do a one-off solution. You land up in a place where ultimately what you need is very much like what other people need. Now you can buy it in the marketplace and you can trade, I like this about this one and that about that one. And so there are these criteria for going through and selecting things, you know, reliability and maintainability and availability and understandability and all of those things, which engineers refer to as the abilities. And you can use them to select among those. Okay. Then you build something, and then see how well it works. Now, how am I going to know how well this thing works? You know, so we got this vision, we're going to go out and buy one or build one. How do I know if it works? What's that?
Talk to people
who use it and ask them if they like it.
Yeah.
But they don't know any other system, so they might like it or they might hate it, but I don't know what to do with that information. What's that? You mean not let everybody in at once, get some pretty savvy users in.
Or maybe just the representative, like maybe somebody from Circulation, somebody from Acquisition, somebody from...
Okay, and then do a focus group or something to get them talking to each other. Okay, so this is indeed what you do. You take the system, and you first do some kind of an alpha test, you know, just to see if when you flip the switch it comes on. Then you run the system in parallel with whatever it was you were doing before. Maybe around for the conversion from catalog cards to online catalogs. You've got the full catalog cards still in the library and the online terminals, and you maintain both systems. And you train some people to use the new system, and then you see what happens to usage rates. So we run parallel systems for a little while, and we use measurement instruments like surveys, focus groups. Then once we've got confidence in the new system, we take the catalog cards and put them in the basement. If they're not gone, and then after a while we turn off the lights on the catalog cards and we sell them for scrap paper. So this is indeed what's going on with the high school's web page. The old web page, the college formerly known as CLIS, right? Still has a cliff.umd.edu web page, but you know, you can click on the web page and say, no, I don't like the new one, let me see the old one, because it may be that the new one screwed up in some way. And what we'll do is we'll measure how often people say, no, I don't like the new one, show me the old one. And when people stop saying that, time to do away with the old one. All right, so you can let people sort of vote with your feet by doing these things in parallel. This is the type, you know, search engine companies in a competitive market do this. They come along and they say, here's my search engine, it's better than the other search engine. And they try to pull people over, and once enough people come over, the first one goes out. So you do that in a fundamental principle way here. Okay, so you all will remember talking about how your project was going to work. And I told you that if you spent a whole bunch of time designing stuff, you didn't actually have to worry about spending too much time coding it, right? Because your design would be so good. And several of you believe me have spent a lot of time designing it, only to find, well, it took a long time to code it because you were not experienced yet in coding. Right? And then, once you coded it, it turned out it wasn't actually designed right. So, the classic way of doing this is you spend time on design. Right? So, if you understand the requirements well, get the design specified well, design a test plan, then you should be able to just build it the first time. So this gets called the waterfall model because the requirements lead to the specification leads to the software, and the specification leads to the test plan. Right, so this is often referred to as the waterfall model. It's generally discredited only because people can't figure out what the heck it is they want. Now, if I want a system that's supposed to add two numbers together and produce the sum, you know, these are the things computer scientists worry about for a long time, the waterfall model is perfectly fine because I know what addition is. So
computer scientists sort of got misled that you could take the requirements, build the system, and then you could test it to see if it did what it was supposed to do, and if it did, then you were done. But what happened is the task became more complex. The requirements became completely inscrutable. And it's very hard to describe how these things should interact. You know, how should interlibrary loan interact with circulation? Well, it depends somewhat on how cataloging interacts with circulation. So there are all sorts of dependencies you have to work out. And so you see this all the time with software. People come out with software version 1.0. All the geeks run off and buy it. Everybody with any common sense ignores it and waits for version 2.0 to come out, which fixes not only all the problems in 1.0, which were fixed in 1.1, but then there were new problems, which got fixed in 1.2, right? But then at some point they gave up and wrote it from scratch and made 2.0, which was okay, except it had a couple little problems, which got fixed in 2.1, so on and so forth. And so, I mean, this is so ubiquitous these days. You see, you know, how many people have IE7? Yeah, that means there were like six really bad ideas that, you know, had to be replaced. So I think I still have Netscape 4.2 someplace. And then you get into these funny things where marketing says, you know, well, Netscape's on 4 and Internet Explorer's on 7. You would think any reasonable person would think that means for people that Microsoft don't know what they're doing, right? It took them 7 tries to get it right, whereas Netscape got it right 4. The Netscape then comes out and skips all the way to version 7 so that they're not behind. Okay, so this spiral model is what actually happens. Right. When you build these systems, you will build in a spiral, even if you tried to waterfall. What you do is, you'll make a waterfall version 1.0, which will then have to be fixed. And then it'll become so broken, they'll eventually start over again. So you do multiple waterfall models. So you get the worst of both worlds. You're doing this over and over and over again, and every time what you're doing is a very expensive waterfall process. So you really don't want to do that. So here's what people really do. So this is called the rapid prototyping model. The basic idea is that your goal is to get the requirements right. Right? So I want to know how to build that system. Now, how many books have to be in the catalog for me to know if the cataloging interface is right, if the user interface of the cataloging system is right, if the workflow is reasonable? How many books do I need in there? All of them? No, I could get by with 100 of them maybe, right? I mean, we could just like do chemistry or something. We don't have to do everything in the library. So what we do is we have some idea what it is we're going to build. And we don't build that. We build some part of it. It's like, I want to build that whole thing. Okay, what are we going to work on today? Cataloging. Okay, so for cataloging, I want to understand the requirements. So I think cataloging is the thing to do, and I build the cataloging system. But I don't build the cataloging system in a bulletproof way. I just pack it together. The rule is 5 days. If you can't build it in 5 days, the thing you're building is too big. You should be building a part of the cataloging system. And it doesn't have to work on the entire collection. It can do one book. That'll be okay. Doesn't have to do serial. If we could just do one book, we could learn whether or not we're doing it reasonably. Okay, so we choose the functionality to work on. We build a prototype, and then you tune it off to the person who is your customer, and you say, here's the prototype, try it out. And they will invariably say, oh, that's not what I wanted. I was thinking you were going to give me something that would take in LC cooperative cataloging records. Didn't mention that, right? Okay, but it's part of the problem. So, okay, fine. So we'll go back and we'll update the requirements
Now that I really understand the requirements, I'll choose some function to prototype, and I'll go through it. And if you go through this 60 times, not three times, 60 times, 1 week around each cycle, then you get, when you're all done, a complete working system, which can only kind of load three books, but it's a complete working system. All the pieces, all put together, and you have the most important thing you could possibly imagine. You have your customer nodding their head up and down saying, yes, that's what I want. At which point, you say, great, thanks. You write down the requirements, and you go build it using the waterfall model. Right? So the problem with the waterfall model is not that it's a bad way to build software if you know what it is you want to do. The problem with the waterfall model is it's a lousy way to discover requirements. Because you can't learn anything about the requirements until the whole darn thing works. And then what you learn is, that wasn't the requirement. Except, you're out of money. And that's what happened with our integrated library system, was we built the wrong system, and then we lived with it for like a decade. And then, we replaced it with the wrong system, much better wrong system, which we lived with for a decade. Why? Because we had to. Because we moved the entire library every time. And what you want to do is you want to, if you have to design one of these things from scratch, you want to go picking up the pieces, and then once you understand all the pieces, throw away the prototype and go build the thing that does what you actually want to do after you discover it. Clear what requirements engineers do and how they do it? You start out by drawing pictures like that. First you understand, you know, lay of the land. Start drawing pictures like that. You get people to make decisions. Then you go prototyping pieces of it. And once the prototype all the pieces, then you can go with the waterfall. Okay, you've earned a break.
None of the file events work. One
did you wrap this in PhD and then wrap that in PhD again?
You mean when I fill out the class?
Yeah.
I just have it in the area, just kind of all. Yeah, it was all.
Yeah, no, you need to have those two children to get ready.
I'm going to take. 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 I'm going to take.
Okay, so there are really two parts to this story. And so far we've only done one part, which is functionality. What do I want my system to do? We made a list of functions. Not surprising, right? Because we're interested in functionality. Got a list of functions, we looked at the data flow, we tried to look at the requirements. Everything we've done so far is on one aspect of requirements, the function. Well, now that makes sense. If it can't perform the function, then it doesn't matter how well it performs the wrong function. But if it can perform the function, then people are going to ask you about the things that bother them. So for example, how often would it be acceptable for your integrated library system to completely fail? Never? Oh, come now. You don't have that much money. I mean, if you wanted one that never failed, you could just buy 10 of them, run them in parallel. What's the chance all 10 will have failed at any one time? Really small. But you don't have that kind of money. So you have to pay for this kind of availability. Right? So tell me, what are you willing to accept? If I told you I could cut the price in half if you would accept one failure every 4 weeks.
Are we talking catastrophic failure?
Catastrophic, yeah, gone, right? Yeah, yeah, gone. Oh, not that the data's gone, it's just it's not available to you. It's failed, and it will take some time to fix it.
Does it fail at a certain time?
No, it just randomly fails every, what did I say, 4 weeks. You willing to take that?
How long does
the failure take? 15 seconds. Doesn't bother you at all, right? If it comes back in 15 seconds, you'll just, every 4 weeks, your users will be annoyed for 15 seconds, but you know, if that's the worst thing that happened to them that week, you can live with it, right? For the savings in price that I gave you for half price, I can give you something that'll fail that often. You'd be okay with it, right? For an integrated library system. If it's a space shuttle, you'd be like, no, I don't think so. Right? I mean, the space shuttle is flown by computers, and when the computers crash, so does the space shuttle. Right? So, but for ordinary, mission-critical, but not life-critical applications, you'd be willing to take that kind of mean time between failures, that average time between failures, if I gave you a very short time to repair. Now, what if I told you that the time to repair was going to be a week? No. But what if I told you now my mean time between failures was 400 years and that my time to repair was a week? Now what that means is, on average, it'll be 400 years between failures, but you know, you might get a couple of them within a year and, you know, and it might be 8,000 years between the next one. I can't promise you failures at a particular time. The failures are random events. But would you be willing to take 400 years mean time between failures and a week to repair? Yeah, because it's a small chance that you're going to get fired, right? If it fails, it's out for a week, you're going to get fired, but there's not much of a chance of that. And look how much money we can save. Yeah? So you can't answer the question about mean time between failures unless you understand mean time to repair. And you can't understand either of those questions unless you think through what are going to be the effects on your operation. Right? So for example, you would maintain manual backups for something that fails every week. But the first integrated library systems failed every week. And so people maintain manual backups. You know, kind of, it was a novelty when it worked. Right? But then it lets you do things you couldn't otherwise do. And that's why people maintain parallel systems early on. Because predictions of mean time between failures and mean time to repair are typically awful. Right? So you actually have to gain some experience. So if you're talking to somebody who's selling you a system, and they have deployed the system in the field, and they can tell you these things, that's okay. But if they're just telling you that's what they designed for, these are very hard to design for, yeah, right? Okay. Now, you run into other kinds of limitations. So a very common limitation is the number of licenses that you buy for some database content. How many people can be using it simultaneously, right? Or if you have ebooks, how many people can have them checked out at a time, or something like that. So you'll get all sorts of capacity limitations. Some of them come from the technology, and some of them come from the controls on use. How much are you willing to pay for response time? If you do a search in the catalog, and it takes 100 milliseconds or less, that's the blink of an eye, right? 100 milliseconds or less, the user can't tell. But you have to buy, for twice as many searches, twice as powerful a computer that will handle twice as many searches. Would you be willing to accept 200 milliseconds rather than buy an extra computer? How about a second? 2 seconds. Getting close? 5 seconds? Half an hour. So you have to think about where that is, because there's a fairly direct cost to peak load response time. Right? If I want my peak load response time to be faster, it's going to cost me in hardware. And it doesn't just cost me hardware once, it means I have to keep that hardware working. So if I have to buy 2 processors, I have twice the chance of failure now. My mean time between failures gets cut in half when I have 2 processors. Now, of course, if the system will run more slowly on 1 processor, then I have a soft failure, and the hard failure is very rare. But if losing 1 processor kills me, then I'm dead. So I have to think about what my processor architecture is when I start thinking about what happens to failures and response time. Okay, and then of course there are all sorts of issues that are designed in on what kinds of upgrades you need. Right? What can you add additional processors? Can you add additional memory? You get more users on the system, whatever you can need. Okay. This one's a little conventional. What? Doesn't live. There we go. Okay. Anybody here ever use punch cards to program a computer? Okay. So the way punch cards work, what you would do is you build a deck of cards. There's 1 card per line of program, and then you would take the cards over and you feed them into a card reader. And the card reader would read in, and it would run your program while it's reading in the very early versions, or it would spool that to disk, and then it would run whatever was on the disk. So it would run your program in batches. You'd get a batch of programs, you'd stick them in, it'd run your programs, you'd be done. We still do this. If you want to print recall notices, you load the paper into the machine for the recall notices at some time during the day or night, print all the recall notices, and then reload the paper with whatever is appropriate for whatever you're going to do next. So it's useful to do things in batches. In the early days, it was the only way. Now, a much more common way is what you have in all your PCs. You can run multiple programs at the same time. So you could be doing a search of your disk, at the same time that you're using a web browser, at the same time you have an instant messaging window open. Right? So there's only one computer, just one processor, but what it does is it says, oh, wait, gotta do this. Oh, no, this one's more important. And it's sitting here constantly interrupting itself and moving to the highest priority task. So some things that need a lot of attention, like reading your keystrokes on the keyboard, they have a high priority, because you wouldn't want to get 5 keystrokes ahead. Everyone's wanting to get 5 keystrokes ahead, and then they all appear on the screen, but that's kind of annoying. So your keystrokes get high priority, but if it's doing a search of the disk and it takes a little bit longer because it was busy doing something else, you don't really care so much. Right? So there's this scheduling going on inside the machine that's moving from one task to another. Indeed, Unix machines you can log into remotely. So I can have several people on the same machine, all sharing one machine. So this idea is generally called time sharing. I take one machine. In batch processing, I do one thing, and then the next thing, and then the next thing. In time sharing, I have a processor that can only do one thing at a time, but I slice it up so that I get the appearance of doing many things at the same time with just one process. So this is very commonly used. The web is designed differently from that. In the web, I've got cooperating processors. You've got a processor on your desk. It's good at drawing things. I've got a processor in my web server. It's good at sending you things to draw. So it's got like databases behind it and lots of disk space and stuff like that, which you don't have, right? I mean, I can look at the web on this, got no disk at all. So servers doing some of the processing, the client doing another part of the processing, and we've agreed on which part's gonna be where. So if we're doing AJAX, for example, Google Maps, then we have a JavaScript program running on the client side. We've got a program running on the server side that's serving data. And when you scroll in the client side, it demands data through an XML connection back to the client side and pulls that data forward and draws it on your screen. All right, so I've got two cooperating programs and a way in which they interact. And that's characteristic of this idea of client-server computing. Now, this client-server computing was the original way that people did music sharing. So if I wanted to share music with my friends, and I hadn't heard about copyright, then what I would do is I would take my CD, I'd rip the music, and I would upload it to a site. This created a few problems. The most serious being that if I was a lawyer and I wanted to shut down your site, I could just shut down one site and everybody stopped sharing music because it was centralized, right? So client-server computing inherently is moving functions to the server, which means that if I want to control what's happening, I simply go to the server and stop. Right? I think it's going to all the clients to be a big fan of that. Right? So usually in client-server computing, a small number of servers and a large number of clients. So, if you think about it, what we had here was we had some processing went on one side, some processing went on the other side, and we had some way to communicate between the two. But there was no need to have clients and servers to do that. I could have client-client computing, right? My client could have some music on it, and your client could have some music on it. And if I wanted the music that was on your client, I could just go get it from your client. Right? And there'd be no central server to shut down. And so music sharing has been the driving application for this. But peer-to-peer communication is ubiquitous. When I was in Tampa, I had a MSN Messenger connection directly to you. I was pumping video to you. There was no client, there was no server. We both had the same software, right? I could see you could see me, and we were just directly connected to each other through the internet. So all the instant messaging that you're familiar with is in this peer-to-peer mode. Now, when I have a problem to solve, as I told you, if I want to print things like recall notices, I naturally go to batch processing. When I have a single computer available, I'll naturally do timeshare, right, for interactive applications. When I have an asymmetry, I have the information in one place, and I have the users in another place, a client-server design is a natural design. When I have a communication going on, a peer-to-peer interaction is a natural design for synchronous communication, but not necessarily for asynchronous communication. It turns out that in peer-to-peer, it's very difficult to do search. Because if I want to know what's on your computer, I have to ask you. And if I ask you, and I want to know what's on somebody else's computer, I have to ask them too. Or maybe you ask them. So there's going to be quite a lot of communication of information going on to do peer-to-peer search. So the way services like Kazaa, which is a music sharing service, work is they take your query and they send it to every machine on the internet that you know of. And they send the query to every machine on the internet that they know of. Who sends it to every machine on the internet they know of, and if they've seen the request before, they don't pass it on again. So eventually it stops, but only after you sent this to everybody who's active in Kazaa at the same time. Right. And so it doesn't take very many hops before you're using up an enormous amount of bandwidth for something that would have been very easy to do if you had just sent the link. So search doesn't map well onto a peer-to-peer application. It's not that it can't be done. It's that the efficiency comes when you centralize it. Okay. I just want to mention at the end that there, as you're trying to actually do this, you run into several problems. You have the problem, what do you do with the stuff you had before? And you've got two problems. I have to maintain the previous system until I'm ready to cut over to the new system. So my costs are temporarily higher when I'm in the middle of a cutover. And then I have to migrate the information. Imagine I build a new one of these, and the catalog is stored in XML. And previously, the catalog had been stored in MARC records. Like, it's enormous, agonizing getting all my MARC records into XML now. That I've got to go through. So this retrospective conversion is going to be a big problem. When I'm running it, I need to instrument things. I need to find out how, for example, how many things are going down the interlibrary loan, how active interlibrary loan is, so that I can set my interlibrary loan staff size the right way. Right? Because over time, what you expect is that if I invest less in acquisition, I'm going to spend more on interlibrary loan, and I'm going to have a larger interlibrary loan staff and a smaller acquisition budget, smaller acquisition staff. So I want to be able to see how decisions I make are actually playing out. So I want to get management information. The problem is management information is expensive, right? So it costs a lot to get good data quality on the management information. And so you have to decide which management information is worth investing in because it's taking away from your actual ability service. Providing training is another issue with cutover. And then, of course, in the management of all of this, you're subject to all sorts of issues like privacy laws that are shifting out from under you as you're doing this. So things that, you know, you build systems that were designed in an era that had one legal setup, and then they come along with the Patriot Act, and you have to be able to provide the kinds of data that you weren't just, that your system wanted to provide access to. Okay. So far we've been assuming, sort of implicitly, that if you wanted to buy a system, you were going to get somebody to design a system for you, or you were going to go to buy a system from somebody. But it might be that what you would do is you would take a system that was put together by a bunch of hackers as a Tech90 project or something, and then use that in a mission-critical part of your business. Now that sounds nuts, right? So, anybody ever hear of the Apache web server? Okay, so that's how Apache's done, right? It's open source, it's just a, it's not from a company, it's an Apache company. It's just a project, it's a bunch of hackers, and they said, hey, we don't want to have to use the Microsoft web server or Joe's web server. to pay for, let's just make a free web server and give it to everybody. And so everybody's using just about everybody's using the Apache web server. The PHP, there's one project using PHP and MySQL. So that PHP MySQL, it's open source. Free. Not just free sort of binaries. Not like they made it and gave it to you and you can run it. You can change it. Why would anybody in their right mind use software made by a bunch of hackers? So we're making it for fun. I mean, who would you complain to if it didn't work? And yet, the government's like got this policy of using open source software whenever they can. That's the stuff made up by the hackers, right?
Software where you can
open
source
software,
a lot of these hackers talk to each other and work out a lot of the hacks.
So you're saying if I have a system that I can read the source code, mm-hmm. if it's got a problem, some hacker will find it and take advantage of it.
For
fame and glory or whatever
well,
it is.
Well, not necessarily take advantage of it, but sometimes rework it so that the code actually, I mean, if there's a problem with the tool, somebody's going to find it and make it work.
Okay.
I mean, the flip side of what you're saying.
Okay. So, this is the surprising thing. If I buy something from Microsoft, they don't give me the source code. I can't really see how it works if I'm a programmer. And so, it might have all kinds of flaws. But since nobody's seen the source code except the people at Microsoft, if the flaws are still in there when it gets to you, you live with the flaws and you don't know about them. And worse still, Microsoft doesn't know about them. But who will discover them? Some hacker. And they'll take advantage of them until Microsoft fixes them. Have you seen the number of updates you're getting to your Windows operating system? Those are flaws being discovered by hackers. Whereas if I give you the source code, then I say, here, look, I warrant this source code to be error-free, and if it's not, well, you can fix it. Right? So I'll do the best I can, and then you can fix it. So lots of businesses are switching to this open source model because it's got a potential for greater reliability because you can see the source code. But how do you make money by giving away software? Why do people do this for free? Because they have to for their Six Value project, right? It's not really free, they're paying. Why? What's in it for the creators? I mean, okay, some creators do it for fun, some creators do it for experience, most don't. What do you get if you give away your software for free? You get reputation, right? You're the person that knows about this. Now, if I needed to use your software in my company, who would I hire to help me do that? You. After all, you wrote it, right? So you have a great business if you gave away your software for free, helping people figure out how to use it. And so this is where a lot of the revenue stream for open source software comes from. IBM is one of the biggest companies pushing open source solutions because the open source solutions they push are very complicated. And which means that you'll need to hire IBM to help you actually use the darn thing. And they happen to have a lot of people who are very good at using it. So, the open source community would claim that if you buy open source software, well, you have to pay something, right? You got to pay somebody to help you get it to work, and you got to get it copied and get it installed. You got to buy the hardware. So you have some costs,
But if you buy a commercial product, you have all those costs plus the money that company is making. Right? So the open source stuff is very cheap compared to that. And if they have the same management costs, or maybe the management costs are a little higher here than they are here, then it works out okay. You still save money by buying open source.
But the people who make proprietary software will tell you is that if you buy the proprietary software, it doesn't take nearly as much management. And so they'll agree with you that the open source is very cheap. It's just the cost structure is very high. And so this is the argument that goes back and forth. And people pull out these pros in favor of open source. So they say, well, you know, not only is it code that people can see, but as soon as somebody figures out something new to do, we don't need a big spiral development process. We just, somebody puts the new thing in the code. You don't want it? Don't use it. Right? So you get new releases constantly. Somebody finds a problem, they get fixed very quickly. You don't have to talk to the marketing people. If you like the stuff, use it. If you don't like the stuff, so use it. Right? You're not stuck with one vendor. Anybody who knows about how this open source stuff is written, this particular one you're using, can help you out with it. So you don't buy Lotus Notes, and then you can't do anything except Lotus Notes. So the internet essentially runs open source. Right? All the fundamental pieces of the internet are open source. And yeah, you're going to get a license with this. It's not like they're giving it away with no license, but they give you a license that is a standard license, typically, that says what you can and can't do, that comes from a cookie cutter, like the Google Public License or something. So, isn't what the open source people would tell you is in their favor. On the other hand, almost every open source project fails. So if you study the open source projects and you find out which of them have serious companies behind them and which of them are just put together by a bunch of hackers and never really got any companies that turned out to support them, you find out that virtually all the successful ones have serious companies behind them. This is like Red Hat behind the list. That successful open source creates a corporate following. The corporate following creates the revenue stream that pays the programmers that maintain the open source software. So it's not non-commercial software. Right? And that almost every open source project that has ever been started has failed. And that you simply happen to have heard of the one that didn't fail. Right? So getting on open source in version 1.0 is way worse than getting on anything else in version 1.0. In fact, most open source starts at like version 0.9 and never makes it past 0.95. Right? Never makes it to 1.0. You remember how developed by engineers was a good thing in the view of the people who didn't like marketing? But, I mean, think about it. What do marketing people do? Marketing people translate between geek speak and what you think you need. There's somebody you can have a conversation with. But, I mean, if the engineers have no marketing people, who's keeping the engineers connected to the customers? Who are the engineers writing this stuff for anyway? Right? They're writing it for engineers, because there's no structure guiding them. So, it's developed by engineers, yeah, but for engineers. And it's a little difficult when something doesn't work out well to figure out who to hold accountable for it. So you really need a plan B if you're going to do this. And plan B might be another open source solution. But what do you do when something that you've been using is no longer supported? You remember the fiasco where everybody downloaded this FTP thing that the university was pointing you at? And well, it turned out it used to be free, but now it expires in 30 days. And so everybody had to run off and get something else, but the university wasn't pointing people at it. So it's a classic problem with open source solutions. The university had no control over it. It wasn't like the university had a contract with these people. Who would they contract with? Right? Okay. All right, so those are a set of sort of broad issues. How do you get from the beginning, thinking about the problem, all the way down to the implementation? What kind of hardware do you run it on? What sort of structure do you have for the industry as a provider? Now, this is the fun part of class. What I want you to do is go to this URL. All right, notice the way it's capitalized, capital risk. And pick a date near your birthday. Now, I don't care if it's near your birthday this year or some previous year. Pick a reasonably recent birthday of yours. And pick some case of unexpected consequences. So this risk digest is, I don't know, going on for 15 years. And it's somebody who collects stories of Murphy's Law. If anything can go wrong, it will go wrong at the worst possible time. So find one of these cases of unintended consequences, and then work backwards. Read the story and try to understand what actually caused the problem. Right? What was the original root cause for the problem? Not the whole story of how it gets done, but you know, you have these stories about, you know, the cat, you know, screamed, and somebody dropped something, and the thing broke, and you know, you get these sort of cascading events, and in the end, the airliner crashes. Right? So let's work back to the root cause. Take about, I don't know, 5 or 10 minutes to do this. And then we'll go around and talk and find the most interesting ones. Scroll down, for example, I want to see my birthday in 2005 to 2007, so I'll go there. And I got three. And then volume 24. And there should be a list of dates. What's that? Why do I not have a list of dates?
So who's time to go?
There's a story around my birthday last year where there's a federal whistleblower website, and somebody from one of the congressional committees sends an email to all the people who have submitted, putting them all in the queue line instead of putting them all in the BCQ line.
thank you for your whistleblower report. Informing everyone of every other whistleblower.
How many of you have inadvertently done something like this?
Yeah, okay.
You would think we could design systems that would guess that these things weren't appropriate and say, are you really sure you want to be stupid? Okay. Well,
talking about a bug in Excel that assumes that the year 1900 is a leap year, and the holdover from Lotus 1, 2, 3, and it just had kept perpetuating itself into all these versions of Excel.
So you're saying that the year 1900 isn't a leap year because odd-numbered centuries, which would otherwise be leap years, are not, but even-numbered centuries are. So 2000 is, but 1900 wasn't. And somebody created a spreadsheet in which they got that wrong, and everybody since has copied the code from the bad spreadsheet.
Yep.
Without checking.
Right.
Okay. Who else has got one of these propagating errors?
Thanks to Pakistan trying to ban YouTube in their country, YouTube was actually shut down worldwide for over 2 hours because they tried to hijack the IP address just in Pakistan, but it ended up hijack it for the entire world.
Okay. Any others that were fun?
That's kind of a downer after all these, but the Justice Department of Japan is in charge of maintaining records of birth, death, marriage, birth. And when they're going from hard copying to digitizing these records, if a child dies before marrying, they just delete them because it's not where they live.
All right. Could create a few problems.
$218 trillion phone bill.
Now wait a minute, a $218 trillion phone bill doesn't make much sense.
Well, it has something to do with, I don't know.
They make a lot of long distance calls?
No, he didn't make any. Apparently, it's disconnected a lot. But there's something about going to a 64-bit arithmetic
tuition
bill.
I see. So they subtracted two numbers and they got really, really, really big number. Because they changed the way in which numbers were represented inside the computer.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you think the people that designed the new numbers thought of that one? Apparently not. Either that or they didn't have a telephone. Any others?
No. The police in some German town sent their secret information on terrorist investigations to the press list.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not quite as bad as any of the terrorists.
Well, terrorists will find out in about a day or two.
Okay. Yeah.
Due to a lack of proper testing, a software upgrade to UK train tickets, much like our metro tickets, caused all train tickets to be demagnetized. So they had to reissue all the tickets that people they had to audit.
Every ticket that had, every current ticket.
Every ticket, so you had monthly passes, monthly things, demagnetized.
That's cheerful. Think about that when you're testing your website. Any others? Okay, so here's my favorite one. Qantas flight QF2 from London to Sydney via Bangkok, a Boeing 747-400, suffered a total loss of electrical power 15 minutes before landing at Bangkok. Investigation showed the following cause. A fiberglass grip shield above the E-rack had a crack that allowed water to drip through. The last check of the airplane at depot maintenance didn't discover and remedy the crack. Qantas had outsourced its maintenance. And it turned out that six other Qantas 747s had similar cracks. The flooding of the first class cabin from the galley is a regular occurrence, usually from ice drains, but sometimes from blocked drains. When the galley floods, the water goes down in the equipment bay directly below it. The galley drains in first class were blocked by coffee grounds.
Lotus had previously changed from pillow-style coffee bags to round coffee machines to save cost. And First Class Aquatus also has a cappuccino machine, which also produces coffee grounds. So you can see that there was a crack. There was a decision to change over to coffee grounds. There was a misplacement of where the electrical power routing was in the 747 under a place where a crack and the coffee grounds could then cause you this problem. So why is it that we get problems like the ones we talked about? Nobody who anticipated these problems would have let this happen. I mean, some things like this are life critical. Some things like the telephone one are just sort of so strange they're hard to believe, right? Some things like the parent information being sent to the press could be a serious problem for the list of whistleblowers. Why do we let these things happen?
Why do we enclose the gear with a loose division? Because we're not sending that far in advance.
So that's the cause of the problem. We do not understand how these systems work. There are so many complex parts that we're building systems whose operation no one understands. Now, how many of you have cars? Do you understand how your car works? Do you have problems like this with your car? Does your car, like, the lights suddenly come on and the horn starts honking?
The wiring problem.
As often as with this stuff, the things that we have that are analog, that are parts of our physical world, they behave in ways that we understand. You push down the accelerator, you go faster, you go back on the accelerator, you go slower. The digital things work perfectly right up until the time they break. Right? Digital things don't bend before they break. So our intuition fails us. In fact, if you want to design out these problems, you want to design systems that behave in ways that are more like our experience in the real world, that start to fail to a small degree, and then get left unchecked, get worse and worse and worse and worse, and eventually become awful. Right? Just like real systems, physical systems. But digital systems don't behave that way. And indeed, one of the nice things about digital systems is their high reliability. But they're getting their high reliability by being very fault tolerant, right up until the time that last fault drops them over the edge. So my very favorite one of these is a case in New York City in which the phone system in Lower Manhattan went out for 2 hours during the business day. Now that's a relatively expensive occurrence on Wall Street. So what caused it? Well, it turned out that there was a power failure in Lower Manhattan. Now that's not an uncommon event. In fact, there's a automatic generator in the telephone office. It comes on automatically when there's a power failure. But it doesn't come on immediately. It takes a moment to come on. And so there's a battery that powers the entire telephone office, both while the power is coming on, and if the generator fails, it provides half an hour of power for the central office. There's a light in the central office that indicates when it's on battery power. And the bulb was burned out. And so
the power in Manhattan failed. Nobody in the telephone switching office noticed for half an hour until all of a sudden the telephone switching office said it shut itself down when the battery died, exactly as it was supposed to do half an hour after it started running without the generator, which had failed, coming on the line. It was a burned out light bulb. It caused the problem. But the people who built the light bulb didn't think, oh, maybe it would be good to have two light bulbs for this, or a light bulb and an alarm, or, you know, some other way besides just the light bulb. Okay. So fundamentally, the problem is that the systems are just so complex that we can't ever hope to find all the bugs. I promise you, for any one of you, bring me your project and let me beat on it for a while. I can find some behavior your project has that wasn't what you had intended. Because keeping traceability from your requirements, your imagination of what it's supposed to do, down to your implementation, requires keeping track of more details than any human being could ever remember. So you'll never find the last bug. Why are you smiling?
Nervous smile.
Now that I've told you about how poorly we understand how well our systems work, here's the real scary one. The electric grid in the United States used to be controlled by a bunch of people sitting in physical places with physical control. But now it's controlled entirely remotely through the through digital networks that are connected to the internet. Which means really all you need is the user ID and password, and you can shut down the electric grid in the United States. So there are all of these types of critical infrastructure that are subject to nefarious activities. Banking and finance. Who do you have ATM cards? If you go to the ATM tonight and you put the card in and take out $200, you'll have $200 in your hand, right? Where did the $200, what has $200 less dollars now? Some database someplace, right? That's what has $200 less dollars someplace. So if I'd like to attack the United States, I don't have to shut down the electric grid. I could just go reduce all the bank accounts by $200 and destroy confidence in the financial system, right? Which would make it hard to do an awful lot of things. So we put in, I shut down the telephone system, shut down the banking system, shut down energy, air traffic control. So the way that air traffic controllers control airplanes is by typing into their computer what they want the airplane to do. And then maybe they read it to the airplane, or maybe it gets sent digitally. Ultimately, it just gets sent digitally. But even if they read it to the airplane, their computer thinks the airplane is doing a certain thing. And then at some point, one controller passes the airplane off to another, and the computer simply passes the data from one controller's face to another. So all I have to do is intercept it at that point and change a few things, and I can crash a few airplanes in New York, where, you know, a whole lot of airplanes trying to get into a small number of airports. So there are an awful lot of things that you can screw up through the network. So think about whether or not this actually makes sense to control all these things through the network. You would want them to be controlled through private networks, not networks that are interconnected to the internet. And you'd want to keep very secret the way you did it, so you wouldn't want to like send the instructions. You see where problems will come from here. So there's actually a plan for dealing with this. And the plan talks about, as you would expect, preventing the problem and dealing with the problem. So there's a response system that looks at the problems as they're occurring in each of these areas. Right? So there's somebody looking at air traffic control trying to understand how it's working. There's somebody looking at the GPS navigation satellites trying to make sure they understand how they're working. There are people looking at the internet, looking at the traffic flows on the internet, trying to understand whether there are problems there. And so they're trying to see if there's a problem, warn people if there's a problem, respond immediately to the problem, and then put the system back together. So that's one set of things that people are doing. At the other level, people are trying to prevent problems from occurring by building interlocking sets of ways of reducing the vulnerability, training people, and then the other two pieces of this are focused on national governments and international cooperation. So this is up on the web if you want to look at the National Cyberspace Strategy and see how people are thinking about it. So the worst problem is that we do it to ourselves. We build systems that fail when we're intending to make them work. But then on top of that, there are systems that fail when people are intending to make them fail. Right, and viruses on your computer are a small version of I'll shut down the U.S. electric system, or I'll destroy your confidence in the bank. Okay, well, I'm not sure for that. The key here at the end of the course is that we started out thinking about very small scale issues. I mean, if you think about what we did the first week, we tried to get things you typed into the keyboard to appear on the screen. We tried to get things that were on your disk into your RAM and into the cache. Right? It was all very sort of micro scale. And then we tried to build software above that. And then we tried to build things like databases above that. And then ultimately we started interacting with the user, with human-computer interaction above that. And then we started getting to these sort of larger issues, like the issues last time, who's allowed to use my computer, how do I keep people from doing things I don't want them to do. And then we get to this very large scale problem, that what we've done is we've taken quite a lot of the designable complexity in our society, and we have given it to a group of people who don't really understand much about our society, computer programmers. Right? And we've asked them to build things that they don't themselves understand. And then we've looked at the consequences of that and asked the question, how should we be organizing our efforts to live with the fact that we don't actually know how the systems we build work anymore? So that's sort of the whole development of the class. You know, we take a circle, and then when we come back, talk about the exam. What's that? Actually, that is among the most fun parts of the class. Well, but nobody believed me on that. At least I have a chance people will believe that going to Bentley's is more fun.
I
Okay, so this is among the most common questions at this point in the semester. Tell me about the exam. The exam is a university final exam, right? So it's not an in-class final, it's during the final exam period. And final exams are required to be 2 hours. So it's a 2-hour in-class final exam. Now, it's not designed to take 2 hours to answer, but you have 2 hours to answer.
How long is the night for?
Oh, about half that. I mean, you get tired. You know, you get like 2 hours of work and you're just constantly working for 2 hours. So it's designed to be answered as about half that. All right. It has similar question styles to the midterm, but you will see different topics on the final. It's a reasonable guess that you will not get a copy of the midterm as the final, right? So maybe there will be something that was asked on the midterm also asked on the final. Although if you look in the past, I don't think that's ever actually occurred. Right? But it might. It's not for everything. But in general, it will be the only opportunity to examine you on what happened in the second half of the class. And as you've noticed by now, I hope the second half of the class is a very different character than the first half of the class. It's about discussing things. And so you get questions like, Tim's past experience includes network security, and he mentioned that he's developed systems based on public key encryption. Your colleague from Human Resources is puzzled by that. Give a clear explanation of how public key encryption works. So, I mean, it's not quite an essay question, but it leaves you a lot of room to structure the question yourself. So one way of addressing concerns that have been raised about the use of strong encryption is 128-bit encryption, or encryption that's got a long enough key to not be easily broken, would be to make public key encryption illegal in the United States. Give two arguments that you would expect to be raised by opponents of the decision to make it illegal. So we're starting a debate in the Congress, and we've got, you know, we're arguing on this side in favor of security. What are we arguing on that side in favor of? Right? Why isn't it illegal already? There must be some good reasons. Okay, so these are designed to be a little hard to Google. You know, Google two good arguments, you know. Not sure what you find. You learn from Tim that he's familiar with the way recommender systems work. To test his understanding, you ask him to explain how it would be possible to use a recommender system in a public library to recommend books that a patron might be interested in borrowing while protecting the privacy of other borrowers. Right? So it's that privacy protection business that's not necessarily too straightforward. And then here's a one that you would have been familiar with in the midterm. Everyone on your team needs to build web pages, so you develop a quick test for each applicant to see if they can build a web page. While you ask, you have to build a web page and display the picture of a gazelle. And to include text under it that identifies the source of the image and includes the word color. Great. The midterm. Figure out what Gazelle and Oligarch have to do with each other. Okay. Here. One from today. Another of the applicants, Shelley, might be a good fit for your new systems analysis center. One of your clients asked you to design an integrated system for managing technical reports that they generate as part of their research and development effort. Every report needs to be digitized, indexed, stored, searched. Information about your holdings is shared with the industry Association Central Technical Report Service, and reports have received little use or moved off in storage. Draw a data flow diagram, right? For each of the major functions to be supported, connect the components using labeled arrows to indicate the type of information that's
change in the direction of the rules. Just straight out of the net. Ooh! Quick thing I didn't raise it. Okay, anyway, you get the idea of the style of questions. I mean, you know, this is very much like the previous questions, just asking about different things, and then there's some other questions they ask you for. Yes? Okay. To prepare for the final, the fall 2005 final is available, and the answers are available. So you might want to save that and do a timed final. And study with the rest of them. Okay. And the most popular part of the exam is the post-exam discussion, which occurs by tradition someplace where beer is served. And the first round is on me. Oh, I should mention, course evaluations are not ready. Third, first round's on us. Usually about half the class comes, and it's a time to unwind and talk about what you're going to do next. Tell me things you didn't want to put in your course evaluations. So it's great fun. Okay, we usually do it at Bentley's, but I've learned to call over to Bentley's because one time out of seven, Bentley's is overrun with 400,000 undergraduates having some kind of a party that reserved the whole place. So I'll call to double check. So if you're skipping the exam and just coming to Bentley's, do check. Actually, we have a picture of it.
I know, but that's impressive.
Well, it's southbound Route 1, but I'll draw a map. Something like the jail. Not today. I'll draw a map. During the exam. You're taking the exam. I'll be working. Okay. So, you should now understand the grand plan. What's that?
I think Google says they came across an article on crypto.
Besides, how else would be stabbed outside Bentley besides the victim? Okay. We'll go someplace else if you like. We used to go to the 94th Aero Squadron, but the 94th Aero Squadron stopped serving pitchers of beer. And you had to buy the beers individually, so it's getting a tad expensive. But the best story ever came from one time when we went over to the 94th Aero Squadron, and immediately after the party, I walked over, got in my airplane, and flew away. And that one still shows up. I promise I didn't drink any beer, but that one still shows up in graduation from time to time. Although I would have thought it was going to be long, before September 11th, when I flew the airplane. Okay, so these are the things that we've done. We've talked about this before, then these are the things that we've done since. And we've got slides for each one of them. So you've seen all these slides for what happened before, so these are the exact copies of the previous ones. And then these are the things that we've discovered, we've discussed since. So we discussed how people have to make sense of what they see their machines doing. So the machine has a model of the person, and the person has a model of the machine in their head. And when they control a machine, they control the machine based on their mental model, based on the predicted behavior. So you have to give them some kind of metaphor, some kind of way of thinking about the way the machine works. Okay, so we talked about input and output devices. We talked about machines being good at some things, people being good at other things, and different types of interaction styles. We didn't get through all of the HCI slides. The ones we didn't get through, of course, we won't. Computer-mediated communication, for which I contributed by leaving. examples of synchronous, asynchronous, remote, local, one-to-one, many-to-many, the different kinds of things that the computer can do to support communication. And then two kinds of communities, one I forgot to put on the slide, but the intentional cooperative work tasks and the more tacit interaction online communities. The web, you remember the octopus, right? Both sides. And so we talked about its characteristics. We talked about there being deep webs. It's a different kind of a place. Has different characteristics. So this is the surface web. And there are a bunch of statistics in web characterization. Search engine, the most fun class. Nobody believes it. We talked about how you can make sets of things very easily for Boolean search, how we can do rank retrieval, how recommender systems work, the answer to the question we just talked about. We talked about some special things in web search, like taking advantage of the link structure and using that to index anchor text that describes a page. And we talked a little bit about how we know how well it's working. Right, how good is this rank list compared to that? Policy, there were four key issues. The ownership issues, so how we would decide what rights people should have, the equity issue, and the control issue, how we would enforce the decisions that we made. Identity management, privacy issues. The privacy issues are very different in what the government can do. For example, the government subject to the Privacy Act of 1974, whereas commercial interests are generally subject to things like Federal Trade Commission enforcement of their privacy policies, their own privacy policies. So very different enforcement regulations. And then the integrity of the information. So if I put something in, whether that's what I get back out. If it's one of the articles I was looking at, Risk Digest, was somebody that had replaced one of the pictures in the Internet Archive with something that wasn't on the original web page. And there have apparently been a few court cases where people have said, oh no, here, in the Internet Archive, it says this. And it's like, well, okay, fine, but now show me the chain of evidence that gets from the original web page through the Internet Archive and back to what you're showing me that causes me to believe that that's what was on the web at the time. Right? So I'll believe that the Internet Archive claims this, but what do I do that causes me to actually believe that? That would be interesting to say. Okay. And then we talked about the system. And this is indeed a picture of Bentley. So you get to Bentley by going south on Route 1. And it is, if you go out that exit of the campus, it is a block and a half to the south of the campus on the left-hand side. Questions? Yeah?
Is parking there?
No. Rain nickels.
Across the street was CVS and Noodle & Company. Or you can park behind Cornerstone, which is the bar next to it.
Other important questions? No questions about the final? Nope. Yeah.
Just like last time, open node.
Open everything. Okay. Open mind. It's just not open neighbor.
Does it longer this
time?
I mean,
the time
that we're on
the
end
is longer?
It's 2 hours.
That's
right.
Okay, and when does
it, 2 hours start?
After we finish the, going over the contents of the exam. So we'll start to go over the contents of the exam promptly at 5:30, and then probably 5:45, you'll be up and running. For about 7:45. Well, I should probably be at Bentley at 8.
How and when will you be told to be grades for projects?
The projects will be graded after I've had a chance to read the project reports, which will be turned in when you do the presentations next week. I wouldn't expect anything would prevent me from grading those before the final, which means that I should be able to give you back project grades at the final. It would probably be kind for me to give them back to you and turn in your final rather than give you. But I can probably give you back marked up copies. Giving back marked up copies of the final is more complex. It can be done, but your course grade will show up on the test wheel or whatever it shows up. Yeah.
Do you want a hard copy of the paper?
I don't really care. If you give me an electronic copy, I'm going to print it. So you can give me a hard copy and just say, hey, pretty. I've got color pictures in it or something, it'd be easier if you do that, because I'm just going to print it black and white. But I'm printing it just so I have something to write on. But it doesn't matter. Other questions?
Yeah. It seems like a lot of us didn't really stick to the script for the short presentation, so we have to.
Well, so there are 9 groups, and there are 150 minutes. I haven't done the math, I probably should. If everybody took 15 minutes, we would finish 15 minutes early, right? So we've got 2.5 hours, 9 groups, 15 minutes each. So everybody should plan 15 minutes each, and we should.
Whenever you're done.
Okay, and we should plan to leave early. Well, what will really happen is everybody will run over, and we will leave way late. We won't leave before the last group's done, so the last group can kill the earlier groups for having run over.
And on the syllabus, it says, only 2 people should present and things like that. Is that only sticking to that? Or?
I don't really care.
Okay.
If everybody, what I don't want to have happen is that everybody presents because they think it's going to be important that everybody do that. It's not important that everybody do the design, it's not important that everybody do the testing, and it's sure not important that everybody do the presentation. Right? So, specialized roles are perfectly fine.
Can we go first?
Can
I go first?
Wait a minute. Why not? So, you will want to set up your presentation during the break before you present. You don't want to come up and start downloading the thing and find out, oh no, it won't read my memory stick or whatever. So you want to set up whatever presentation materials you have beforehand. If you have a laptop, you can present off the laptop for PowerPoint slides while demoing the website on the other side. You would be really wise, however, to put your PowerPoint slides on the machine that's being on the machine here and using your laptop to present. Because you can be sure you will have exactly the version of the web browser that you're expecting on your laptop. Whereas if you depend on this one, you can be sure that they will have just installed Internet Explorer version 2.6 or something just to screw you up. And we'll do it the night before. Yeah?
Is there an expectation that we have that PowerPoint slide, or can you just demonstrate and speak from the
heart? Oh, you can certainly just demonstrate and speak from the heart. You don't have to build PowerPoint slides. But I often find it useful myself to use PowerPoint as sort of a set of notes of things to talk about. So most of what I talk about isn't reading the PowerPoint slides, but the PowerPoint slides are a nice way of looking at what we're having. So if you want to do it. I would like, before we come to class next week, URLs from all of you, where your project will be. It's fine with me if your project continues to evolve until class starts, but I'd like to have a set of URLs that I can put on the web page so people can see each other's projects. And I ask that you not bang on the projects while they're giving the demo. Okay. Please do leave time for questions when you give your presentation. Rebecca says that she will come and she will ask tough questions. Unless you get too early. Well, there are basically two things. One is what this project does. The other is what you learned along the way. I would expect that the interaction with the client would have turned out to be surprising to you. If it didn't, that too might be worth mentioning. You know, it doesn't have to be a surprise, but usually, if you've got a client, the client drives your thinking as your project evolves. People often have comments about the kinds of tools that they found that are of interest to other people who are going to be building things in the future. It's a great opportunity to learn from each other about specific tools. One of the things that you'll notice this class is weak on, intentionally, is specific current tools, right? Because 3 years from now, those are out of date. We spend time talking about ideas and then use the project to pick up knowledge on tools. So it's a nice opportunity to talk to each other about what tools are there. Almost always, somebody has really good stories about the mythical man month. Occasionally, there are engaging stories about team interactions that people are willing to say in public. And I haven't yet seen a case in which people didn't have several surprises along the way, right? Several things that they learned about the process. So it's nice if people can walk in your shoes a little bit. It's not so much important to get every detail of how the project actually works. You see every page sort of thing.
We're not expecting to regurgitate the whole report.
There's a report there for just that. And so you've got to be somewhat selective in talking about the interesting things. It'd be really boring if everybody thought and followed the same cookie cutter structure. So, hey, there's a project which I will look at with your report in front of me. There's a talk and there's a report. So you don't have to do everything in the talk. So one thing I'll tell you that people often are very nervous when they're doing their presentations. So it's rare that we get to do presentations to the entire class. There are 14-week semesters and 15-week semesters. And we only get to do this in the 15-week semesters. In the 14-week semesters, every one of the demos is private. Right? You come to my office and I'll pull out 5 different my browsers and we'll work on your project for a while. And I ask people when they come what grade they're expecting. You know, after they told me about the problem, the project, and I've always been shocked by what low answers I get. And I, you know, it just seems to me if anybody ever asked me that question, I go for A+ without thinking, right? Regardless of what I've done. But I've always been just tremendously impressed by the whole set of projects in the class. So, I mean, come in here next week and have fun. Show off. Share ideas. Don't be afraid to tell people what you learned along the way. The project is an opportunity to build something you didn't think you could do when you started. Right? When you started the class, you didn't have the skills to do some part of it. You might have known HTML coding, but not know the design issues, or not know the working requests, or whatever it was. Share that. It's a, I mean, it's a real celebration of what we've done together, what you've done in the semester. So have fun. Don't worry. Worry about the grade between now and the moment that talk starts. But don't worry about the grade. You're not gonna get graded down for, you know, giving a talk that's not perfect. Don't worry about that. Have fun. Talk to each other. Okay? See you all next week. We'll be here about 15 minutes early for the people that want to set up for the first one. Just stack yourself up in order, and we'll get on the order. Presentations next week are recorded unless you specifically ask that they not be, and will be available on the internet. Right? So if you don't want that to happen, we'll do it.
In fact, I think you can use it.